You're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHEN LPFM Radio 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community supported radio, and we're streamed on the internet at khen.org. And if you would like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they're available at www.gimmesometruth.info or link from the khen.org website. And tonight I've got a special guest, Daniel Estulin. And he's born in Russia, is an author, public speaker, investigative journalist, and conspiracy theorist who specializes in researching and reporting on the Bilderberger Group. And he has also come out with a recently new book called Shadow Masters. And Daniel, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, yeah, I'll actually subtract the conspiracy theorist part. I'm actually the conspiracy theorist has been replaced by 100% mainstream. I've been invited to speak at the European Parliament in Brussels on 1st of June on Bilderberg Group, and I'll be surrounded and supported by some very, very important European leaders, such as Mario Borghesio from Italy and Nigel Farage, the leader of the UK Independent Party. So, again, Bilderberg has gone 100% mainstream.
Wonderful. And somebody I had run into said, well, if you're not a conspiracy theorist, then you are an accident theorist or coincidence theorist. So
that's right. That's it. Yeah. If you're gonna call me a conspiracy theorist, let me call you a coincidence theorist. That's right.
So, Daniel, I'd like you to just go ahead and get started, because I have a feeling that you can pretty much just go ahead with this thing, and I can just throw in some questions here and there on this.
They call me water because I just fill any space. I don't know if it's an insult or as an acknowledgement.
It's probably a lot of practice.
It has to be that.
Both of your books are very good books, and The Shadow Masters is definitely one I feel that is apropos to what's going on in this country right now to understand what may be down the road for us. Do you think so?
Well, you know, in the Bilderberg book, what I do is I explain how a very powerful clique of some of the most powerful men and women in the world control the destinies of humanity. And in The Shadow Masters, what I actually do is go down the rabbit hole and explain who some of these doers are, the executioners of some of these whims that the Bilderbergers actually have. And it's certainly as the panorama in the United States, but also in Europe, is desolate. And you can see from today's events, the stock markets crash, in Europe and in the United States, that we really are living off a world financial meltdown. It's a systemic meltdown. It's not something you just throw a lot of money at. It's the world as we know it, its financial world, the way it's structured right now, is coming to an end unless something is done. We're going to be living another deja vu of 1345 financial crash, which brought down the Bardis and the Peruzzi banking houses and wiped out the not only European economy, but Europe as a whole, you know, through the bubonic plague, which destroyed half of the Europeans' population.
So, I'm just going to let you go for it and tell us a little bit about what you know, your whole point and why you wrote this book, The Shadow Masters. And I do realize that I've been a little bit ignorant of the what goes on in Russia and in Eurasia, and it's really nice to get to talk to somebody that has a little bit better grasp of what's going on there.
Well, basically what I've done in this book is I've shown how a lot of events, which in a real world really should not be connected in any way, shape, or form, are very much connected in the world of smoke and mirrors that we live in. Like, for example, what does Russia, the Taliban, the Kosovo terrorists, the United States government, drug trade, you know, alleged world's biggest arms dealer, Victor Boot, Litvinenko, what all these characters have in common? Well, they're all connected to the same, you know, characters and individuals who I, you know, talk about, you know, going down this rabbit hole, the doers, the executioners. And basically, again, if you understand that the final objective of this motley crew of individuals is not to create what everyone calls New World Order, One World Government. I'm sure you're familiar with the phrases. It's a fairly stupid concept. It has never been One World Government and New World Order. It has always been One World Company Limited. It's the ideology that these people represent, and that's what Bilderberg is, and that's what the final objective is. Now, if you take that as the final objective, you have to understand that only two nations stand in the way, Russia and China. But China, militarily, is not a competitor. You know, they simply don't have the knowledge of technology, you don't have knowledge to actually do anything to NATO alliance or to the United States. And case in point, for example, the Chinese, they don't even know how to make a mini nuclear bomb, which is called a suitcase nuke, which only goes to show that, you know, their grasp on technologies is fairly limited when it comes to big boys. So the only nation actually in the world that not only is as powerful militarily, but actually more powerful than a lot of their weaponry is actually Russia. And they can wipe out NATO more times than NATO can wipe them out. And obviously the Bilderbergers who control NATO lines, they very much understand that. So the idea is, again, you destroy Russia militarily, you destroy it financially, you destroy it technologically, you just rip their heart out. And that's the only nation that stands in the way for the creation of two worlds, the creation of One World Company Limited. So what I explain in the chapter, the economic rape of Russia and how the NGOs and George Soros and World Bank and International Monetary Fund and Bill Clinton and company, how they went in actually and tried to help Russia, quote unquote, they actually, you know, did the opposite, destroyed or tried to destroy Russia, except, and they came within a whisker, except that Russians are resilient, and KGB realized it in time and took control of the nation. They just basically got rid of Yeltsin through a coup d'etat and put one of their own in its place. And that's one of the reasons Putin is so much hated in the West, because he basically, you know, thwarted the plans of One World Company Limited, you know, towards creation of their giant corporate cartel.
It sounds like you may have a little bit of a cold there, or is it just...
My book has just come out in Spain. I'm promoting Shadow Masters in the United States. I do about 3-4 interviews a day there. Plus, I'm getting about 17 requests a day from... there's like 64 television stations coming from across the world to cover Bilderberg in Sitges. So I'm doing about 5 hours of interviews a day, so I'm surprised I have a voice left. I should actually contract a ventriloquist to actually take my place once in a while.
Well, but I guess that's a good thing, though. It keeps... But most journalists...
It's like, you know, voice doesn't really need a lot of training. You just open your mouth and talk. So I've unfortunately been doing too much of it. Anyway, so that's one of the things in this book. It's, you know, again, I explain how these people and why. A lot of the things that happen in Russia, which people in the West, and especially in the United States, don't really understand. Really know why it happened and how it happened and how the International Monetary Fund, instead of helping, was actually one of the key driving forces, you know, on the way to try to destroy Russia. And, of course, another key element is the international drug trade, which feeds the monies into the system, such as Wall Street, for example, and keeps the entire world financial system not stable, because right now there is no stability, but at least, immediately melting into oblivion.
Well, you know, if you want to get into a little bit more detail on some of this, because this, again, is what I feel, you know, my audience, and I know myself, has been, gets limited information on, and why I feel, you know, reading your book is, you know, a worthy endeavor.
Thank you. Well, you know, as a question, what do international terrorism, the world's financial markets, empire building, and capitalism have in common? Their utter dependence on drug profits for the very existence. Now, the drug trade, now a lot of people most likely don't understand how it works, is that organized crime, and especially the drug trade, is a lubricating force for the entire world economy right now. There's almost $1 trillion a year in organized drug trade. Okay, that's $1 trillion a year is liquid, and if you think of money, especially criminal money, drug money, as water, which is thin, it can flow very quickly from point A to point B. And in the world markets, where you apply money is where you control business, where you control the markets, you control the banks, you control interest rates. Drug money flows faster. Money that's not criminal money has to go through regulations and banking system. It has to go through taxations. It is tracked. The lawyers follow it. You know, the IRS follows it, the CIA follows it, the government follows it. So that money moves like molasses. And obviously, in the world of business, you know, the faster it gets from point A to point B, obviously, the more money you make. So one of the conditions, again, of of the international drug trade is you're talking about almost $1 trillion a year. That's too much money to hide in a sock. Now, you need a lot of experience and expertise to move such funds stealthily. Obviously, ignorance, especially when laundering transactions such as, you know, $1 trillion transactions, is simply not a tenable option. And so, again, in the world of finance, drug trade is the, you know, key element. And I think maybe we should explain to the audience how the entire drug trade works. What do you think?
Go ahead.
You know, corporations trading on Wall Street all have stock values that are based upon annual net profits. Now, shares of stocks are fractions of ownership in companies, and they represent equity. That's, you know, fairly easy to understand. They're also known as price to earnings, which is the multiplier effect in stock values, and it can be sometimes as a factor as much as a factor of 30. That's because financial analysts have long believed that a healthy price to earnings ratio is, in any stock, is about 15 or 30 to 1, meaning for every $30, one is profit. So therefore, if you take it as a strictly mathematical relationship, by adding just $1 to the company's year-end bottom line, it would create $30 in stock value. You understand?
Uh-huh.
So if you're talking about, if you're talking about 30 to 1, again, it would be the same as 60 to 2, you know, as a fraction, 90 to 3, or 120 to 4. Now, what does this mean in the real world? For example, you take companies such as Chase Manhattan Bank or Citibank, which is one of the biggest drug laundering banks in the world, General Electric or Brown Brothers Harriman. Now, if they were to have an additional $10 million in net profits based upon the drug trade, the net increase in their company's stock value could be as much as $300 million. Now, if you have an additional $20 million in net profit, you're talking about the stock value going up by $600 million. Okay. So,
mm-hmm.
However, before they can actually channel this money into year-end results, they need to do something with these illegal funds because, again, drug money is obviously, you know, dirty money and they need to be washed, which is, you know, very, very interesting that in Colombia, for example, most appliance shops and electronic shops are owned by people with undeniable links to the international drug cartels. Okay. It's also very interesting to know that one of the companies I track as far as laundering drug money is General Electric, who just happens to own NBC. Now, everybody knows that GE brings good things to life. They make DVDs, they make television sets, they make telephones, they make all kinds of, you know, trinkets. But when drug money in South America, you know, a drug dealer in South America, or drug honcho in South America says he wants to buy, you know, $100 million worth of television sets or DVDs, you know, do you think that General Electric actually asks them where that money comes from, or they just, you know, sell them the goods, get $100 million, and that's how you launder money. So, again, if you can do that, you can actually make a lot of money in the process, which is exactly what they do. Now, there's also another way of making fantastic return on that kind of an investment. Corporations, you know, do this all the time. They borrow illegal money from drug dealers at, let's say, 3%, and they, lend it to the rest of the world at 5%. Now, when you're talking about $100 billion, all right, or $1 trillion of useless illegal money, okay, it's loaned at 3% or 5%, and then someone turns around and loans it at a much higher percent, you're talking about a lot of liquidity in the system and a lot of money to be made in the process, which is, again, one of the reasons you could never eradicate the drug trade, because if you ever tried to eradicate it or legalize it, the entire world economy would collapse onto itself because, again, the drug money is laundered through Wall Street, it's laundered through, you know, through the Madrid Stock Exchange, it's laundered through London Stock Exchange in the city. It has always been this way, you know, and until you know, the end of time, you know, drug money has, and until powerful people, you know, continue controlling the world, it'll continue to be the key element, obviously, in the world economy. It's also very interesting to you know, if you remember when the Taliban first came in power in 1996. The very first thing they did after praying to their God is cut all of the, you know, the entire Annapola crop And that was, you know, they literally overnight wiped out an equivalent of about $60 billion, all right, in cash, because these are cash. It's not, you know, credit cards or checks. This is cash. And, you know, several months later, we had this very important Asian tiger crisis, you know, the economic crisis in Asia. And suddenly Wall Street in 1997, you know, found itself without any cash. All right, today, 97% of the country, Afghanistan, is controlled by the NATO alliance. And we have the biggest crop ever. And the allied troops are actually refusing to cut it down, saying that it drives the poor farmers into the hands of the Taliban, which is absolute nonsense. You know, there's a correlation between these two things. And those people who don't understand it, as we say in Russian, are not on very friendly terms with their brain.
That's a lot to take in at the moment, but you're right. I have been following some of this that's behind the drug trade. But do you propose that there's any kind of answer to getting around having this kind of a drug trade?
Of course there is. You know, first thing, if you know, Afghanistan, you know, just again understand what I'm saying, that the American troops are in Afghanistan not to bring democracy, you know, to this godforsaken land. The American troops are in Afghanistan to protect the drug trade. All right. Now, if Americans understand this as a concept, and they understand that the media is lying to them, that it's not about bringing democracy, it's not about, you know, nation building. It's on the one hand about using the drug trade, you know, to support, you know, a dead American economy, and on the other trade, American government has 13 secret, super duper secret bases in Afghanistan, which are being, you know, will be used as a launching pad to attack or Iran or Russia or both, you know, because again, as I said before, Russia is the principal enemy of this entire world trade. But, you know, there's this funny little anecdote. John Gotti Jr., you know, the not a very reliable source, obviously, when asked by a reporter, you know, a few years back, whether or not the New York, you know, the Gotti family was dealing narcotics, he said, no, you know, we can't compete with the government.
Yeah, I have heard that one.
Yeah, that, you know, so again, but, you know, maybe you've heard this one. I'll give you another one. It's not as funny, but it's certainly curious. Back in September 1996, Al Gore, who, you know, the Mr. Global Warming character, you know, he held a fundraiser in New York City for his 2000, you know, presidential campaign. Now, amongst the attendees, according to the DEA and the FBI wiretaps, were the people from the presidential party in Dominican Republic called RPD. Now, one of the people there was the man himself, the RPD boss, by the name of Simon Diaz. And the other man who was there also was also one of the leading organizers for the party, is Pablo Espinal. Now, both of these individuals, they have the Nadis number. Now, Nadis is an acronym for Narcotics and Dangerous Drug Information System. Basically, when someone is under investigating for you know, money laundering or drug trafficking, instead of using their name, they use a number just, you know, to make sure that the investigation is not compromised. So these two individuals, you know, who are the leader of the party and one of the key members of the executive committee, both had Nadis numbers with the DEA and the FBI. Now, every, you know, person present that night at this joint called Cougar's Bar in Upper West Manhattan had criminal record. Now, every single person there had criminal record, and every single person there was somehow related, you know, to the president's party in the Dominican Republic. Now, you obviously understand, you know, everyone who, you know, with a bit of brain obviously understands that anyone who comes anywhere near a vice president of the United States and a future leading contender for the presidency of the country, you know, there's absolutely no way to get anywhere near them, you know, unless the FBI, the CIA, you know, the DEA had you checked thoroughly, vetted thoroughly through, and allow that person to be there. Now, my question is, how in the world do these individuals, you know, being international drug pushers wanted by Interpol and having these numbers for money laundering and drug trafficking, get anywhere near Al Gore without Al Gore's knowledge? Well, of course, they don't. You know, Al Gore knew exactly who they were and exactly why they were there, laundering drug money through his fundraising campaign. And, you know, again, the drugs and politics and Russia and Kosovo terrorists, you know, in China, and Victor Boot, all these characters are, you know, this Daniel Estulin universe and the Shadow Masters.
Well, how did you get into this? I mean, what drew you into doing this kind of work to get with these kind of characters and study them?
Well, I was thinking of becoming a bus driver, but then I thought this was more fun. You know, back in 1992, I was born in Soviet Union, as you said at the beginning of the program. My grandfather was a colonel of the KGB counterintelligence. Back in 1992, living in Canada, I was 26. I had met a friend of his who was a double agent working for the KGB and MI6, I think it was. His cover was blown and he was on the run. So we had lunch before he, you know, literally disappeared into oblivion and in Toronto in Canada. And, you know, in between, you know, mashed potatoes and T-bone steak, he was telling me all this stuff about all these things which allegedly were going to happen 3-4 years into the future. You know, as any person, you know, I see this reaction all the time. You tell him things that doesn't happen, you know, the day after tomorrow. You kind of, look at you glossy-eyed and, you know, if they don't start yawning, they kind of, you know, listen attentively for about 10 seconds, then politely say thank you and leave. You know, I sat with this man, you know, I was in awe. He was telling me that Canada, 3 years into the future, was going to separate, and that Quebec, the French-speaking province, was going to become an independent nation because a very powerful man in the United States needed to balance their, you know, books. And I thought to myself, what is this man talking about? And he was telling me about the secret society called Build or something or other. I couldn't understand. He had too much food in his mouth. You know, lunch ended. Yeah, we said our goodbyes, and I forgot about him. And then 1995 comes around, and suddenly the Quebec separates are making all the right noises, and what this man told me 3 years in the past was coming together very, very quickly and very accurately. So I kind of asked myself, you know, if this guy knew this, you know, he obviously isn't the only one in the world, and if the president and the prime ministers actually are not in charge, then who the hell runs the world? And that's how I got into Bilderberg and secret societies, and it's been a very interesting quest. I've been at it for almost 20 years now.
It sounds like it's been a real interesting trip for you because in doing your book, you had to move over. Did you move over to Thailand? Is that right?
Well, that's right. I spent 6 months living in Thailand because two of my chapters deal with Victor Boot, you know, the alleged merchant of death, the biggest, the worst gun runner in the history of mankind. At least that's how the American government sold us, you know, sold him to us. If anybody's wondering who this character is, there's a film with Nicolas Cage called The Lord of War, and in it he plays this unseemly character by the name of, I can't remember his first name, his last name was Arlov. And, well, this, you know, this character in the film that Nicolas Cage plays, you know, is allegedly based on the life of Victor Boot, but I can tell you that, you know, it's pure fiction and pure propaganda, Hollywood propaganda, because in real life, the story is very, very different. You know, Victor Boot as a character is an amazing character. You know, he's a Russian-born translator. He's probably the highest IQ in the world, according to the United States government and the British government, and I don't doubt it after meeting him and spending a lot of time with him over the 6 months. He's in prison, incidentally, in Klong Prem. He was caught when he came into Thailand 2 years ago on March the 6th, 2008, and he's been fighting the extradition to the United States ever since. And the story is amazing because what I actually show in my book is that, you know, the entire American version of events that so often seem to happen, you know, is just full of, is a pack of lies. It's smoke and mirrors, it's conjecture, it's lies, and you have a lot of, not only does the government and the United Nations inspectors and some very, very powerful and crooked American journalists such as Douglas Farrow had written a book called The Merchant of Death, which is where his, you know, nickname comes from, Victor Boot, The Merchant of Death, you know, have all, you know, come together and created this amazing story about this man who seemed to be, you know, be the most powerful gun runner in the world. Now, the story itself is very, very different. See, Victor Boot, in the early 1990s, when the Soviet Union fell apart, he was working as a translator in Mozambique, in Africa. Now, in 1991, when Russia literally, or Soviet Union, disintegrated into oblivion, he stayed in Africa because his junior lieutenant salary was literally enough for him to buy a cup of coffee. And because he's as fashionable as all those airplanes, you know, he and his brother Sergei, they bought a couple of secondhand Antonov 24 planes, which is, you know, an amazing cargo, solid cargo plane, sturdy, you know, it basically, you know, can take off and land in a space of 5 meters, be it a puddle, be it a swamp, be it in the middle of the ocean, didn't really matter. And what they had done is, you know, they turned these two used airplanes into an amazing monopoly because, you see, what had happened in Africa in the 1990s is the entire, especially 1993, 1994, 1995, the entire continent was ablaze in war. So you had 32 wars, you know, in 53 countries, which basically means the entire continent. And all these Western carriers, you know, the American Airlines and the, you know, the French and the British carriers, they all pulled out, obviously fearing for the, you know, for the safety of their crew. And needless to say, I think more than the safety of their crews is for the premiums they would have to pay if one of the planes got shot out in the sky. And so Victor Boot found himself, him and his you know, kamikaze, you know, pickle-eating Ruski pilots who lost their jobs after the Soviet Union fell apart, you know, basically controlling the whole continent. So on the one hand, when these airlines pulled out, they left, you know, entire continent of 1 billion people with no access to food, no access to medicine, no access to clothes, no access to anything at all. They said, you're on your own. And, of course, Victor Boot came in and he just filled the void. And by 1995, he literally came to control 90% of the entire freight business in Africa. That's a mega monopoly. Not even Microsoft and Bill Gates can claim to have that kind of a monopoly. And then towards the 1997, when the wars began to subside, all of these Western carriers and governments, you know, wanted back in. And, of course, they found themselves in a very peculiar situation where nobody wanted them there. So they created this myth about this one man who allegedly was more powerful than every government on the planet, more powerful than every intelligence agency on the planet, more powerful and more invisible than Interpol, than the Echelon system, than anything that NSA and the Army can come up with. They couldn't find him, apparently. This one man against the world, we're being told, and this one Ruski by the name of Victor Boot could basically outdo and outgun the United States government and every other government on the planet. Now, my question, as I ask in the book, is why were they leading us down this, you know, path? And what I found out is actually the story, and that's how I began to actually unravel the whole thing. And the American government, I can tell you from my contacts in the State Department, they told me they were profoundly, you know, stressed by when my book came out, because I basically 15 years and $80 million of their propaganda was literally, you know, swept down the toilet in a matter of months. And what I had uncovered in Bangkok is that not only did the American government had absolutely no case against Victor Boot, and that he didn't come. He see the charges were that he came to Thailand to sell short-air missiles to the FARC terrorists of Colombia. Of course, that was a lie. He, Derek Audney, just to give you an idea of what kind of characters actually, you know, populated this story, who was the DEA agent in charge, came to offer $20 million of United States taxpayers' money, you know, to a former Russian nuclear intelligence officer to sabotage Victor Boot's case. At the time, this intelligence officer was the man who actually, you know, running Victor Boot's defense. You know, this Russian was smarter than Derek Audney and actually had the whole thing taped on video and audio. So you have the DEA agent in charge in Hong Kong, in Bangkok, and also the assistant district attorney of the United States by the name of Derek Audney, offered $20 million on videotape, you know, to a former Russian nuclear intelligence officer. Now, I'm not a lawyer, but I think it's illegal, okay?
I would imagine.
For example, Victor Boot's second lawyer, who's actually working in his defense, was directly working for the DEA. Now, can you believe that?
I believe just about anything these days.
You know, the guy who was Victor Boot's alleged co-conspirator, a man by the name of Andrew Smullyan, who was in fact a DEA agent, Victor Boot came to Bangkok because he was out of money. But, you know, by the end of 2002, he was squeezed out of Africa, and he came back to live in Russia. And he was out of money. He basically lost everything. And the only thing he had left over the past few years was a couple of, you know, cargo planes, and he wanted to sell them for $250,000 each, which is really not a lot of money. You know, two planes, $500,000, not a lot of money, but when you have no money, it's, you know, it's enough to live on. And so he came to Thailand to actually, you know, sell these two remaining planes to alleged, you know, buyers from God knows where, except that Andrew Smullyan, who was a friend of his for the past 20 years, but at the same time who had a very nasty drug habit, which is how the DEA got him, okay, was actually telling the DEA, because he was working with them, that Victor Boot was preparing to sell shoulder to our, you know, to air missiles to the FARC terrorists. And these are the charges brought against him. So when Smullyan and Victor Boot arrested in Bangkok, and the idea was obviously to bring the two of them to trial, you know, then the story turns kind of funny and nasty at the same time. Andrew Smullyan, well, he disappears out of the hotel. You know, this is a lockdown hotel. Both Smullyan and Victor Boot were guarded by 20 commandos each. And I have photographs in my book. You know, and it just, it, you know, not only is it, you know, physical impossibility to escape these people, but the fact that, you know, he slips, you know, his guard, it makes it out of the hotel, which was surrounded by 200 paratroopers, tanks, and dogs. And again, these photos are in my book. And somehow handcuffed, makes it into a taxi with that taxi driver realizing it, makes it to the airport. Of course, his passport was taken away from him. You know, and books a ticket without a passport, handcuffed, to the only place in the world that, if caught and convicted, is destined to spend 300 years in a slammer. Now, this is the American version of the story. So when I called the DEA agent in charge of Victor Boot investigation in Washington, I said to him, so, like, is this your story? He said, yep, that's the story we're sticking to. And I said to him, and you call me a conspiracy theorist.
So ultimately, just go ahead and continue on with this story.
In the world of intelligence operations, there are no coincidences. You know, as anybody will tell you who actually works intelligence, you know, they're well planned and badly planned operations. Now, the Victor Boot, you know, saga was a very, very, very poorly planned operation. Well, these people never could have imagined. I was told this by friends in the CIA. You know, CIA, they do their, you know, what-if scenarios. Well, they never, ever in their entire life could have imagined that me, you know, of all people in the world, would one day get on the airplane and go to Bangkok, you know, to actually write a story about Victor Boot, because my book needed a couple of additional chapters, and I just thought Victor Boot was a good choice. You know, it's one thing they could never have imagined in their wildest dreams. And when I got there and I saw the evidence and I started, you know, investigating, taking the entire thing apart, I realized that, you know, the entire thing was just a scam, a sham. You know, and this guy's not guilty of anything at all. But why is it that he needed Victor Boot? Because actually, the idea is that a guy like that could never get his hands on weapons unless a powerful nation was behind him. And the story is, again, you know, a pickle-eating Ruski KGB. He was not KGB, but they made him into a KGB in the movie. And in the, you know, incessant bombardment, you know, through the press, he became a KGB officer. But he was never KGB. So where would a KGB pickle-eating Ruski get his weapons from? Well, the only other nation in the world would actually supply it to him, the Soviet Union. So when you actually get to that point, you would basically put Russia and Russia's credibility in the same pariah state status as Iran, North Korea, Cuba, Venezuela, you know, and these other potpourri of scummy nations who allegedly do all this harm to the entire world. So again, the plan is you destroy Russia any way you can, economically, physically, spiritually, technologically, militarily. They tried this back in the 1940s in the Second World War in this operation called Barbarossa. And, of course, they failed. Hitler never got, you know, as far as Moscow. And then they tried it again with Yeltsin. That was called Barbarossa II. And they almost got, you know, what they wanted, which is, you know, taking complete control of Russian economy until Putin came in. And, you know, we Russians were resilient. And so Putin actually put the country back together. And so they came up with this third plan, you know, Barbarossa 3. And what I actually uncovered in the last chapter of my book is that not only that, you know, they need to extradite Victor Boot to the United States, but when he is in the United States, they can actually bring out secret indictment against him, and they're going to charge him with dealing in nuclear components. And again, the insinuation is very, very clear. Where would a Russian, you know, KGB officer get nuclear components from? Well, the only nation would actually supply it to him, the bad Russian government who wants World War III.
So you're saying the Russian government wants World War III?
No, I'm saying that's what the American government is insinuating, and that's what
okay.
They're going to say.
All right.
You know, but again, Victor Boot is not guilty of anything at all. The entire story is a lie. And what I actually prove in my book is that Douglas Farah, you know, former journalist for the Washington Post, you know, the man who's written a very, very popular and well-known book called The Merchant of Death, you know, he lied twice under oath in Congress in his testimony to Congress about the Victor Boot situation. And again, I take the entire American case apart and prove that entire thing is, again, a pack of lies. So again, the whole point is that destabilizing the Russian state, you know, became the goal of the shadow masters after the collapse of the Soviet Union in December 91, and they're still at it. You know, they've been at it for the past 20 years. And in the 1990s, you know, they literally tried to strip the country of all its natural resources and bankrupt Russia. Okay, the final objective, of course, of diverting huge quantities of cash, because they took all that money out of the country. On the one hand, you can weaken Russia and destabilize the entire region from the Balkans, passing through Turkey, Eastern Europe, and Russia. And, of course, destabilization in the region, of course, very well may balkanize Russia, which turn it into another, you know, a regional conflict. Additionally, the increasing U.S. military and Bilderberg-controlled economic presence will consolidate the New World Order's control over the last remaining oil and gas reserves in the region. And this, of course, results in further drain on Russian influence in the region and greatly increase global instability. And global instability offers the Bilderbergers and the Shadow Masters a golden opportunity to sell guns and butter to both sides in the equation. And, of course, the drug trade is basically doing the same thing. On the one hand, you are infecting Russia with the drug trade, and so you have, you know, 30,000 youths a year in Russia who actually die of drug overdose. And if you're talking about drain, not only in the economy, but in the country itself, that's a lot of young men and women who die of the drug overdose.
So who are you going to say is behind all this, or who do you say is behind all this?
Well, the same characters who are trying to create their One World Company Limited. And by that, I don't necessarily mean, you know, the George Soros's or the David Rockefellers, because, you know, there are just a lot of misconceptions about the world politics. A lot of people think that, you know, a guy like David Rockefeller is the most powerful man in the world because he just happened to have founded the Trilateral Commission, and he sits on the, you know, board of pretty much anything, you know, that reeks, smells, or, you know, has a whiff of the New World Order, as you call it. But the fact that, you know, every man, woman, and child and every toilet cleaner in America knows who David Rockefeller is, you know, to an intelligent person would actually exclude him from being important, because the really, 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 really important people are unknown to all but a very, very small amount percentage of people on the planet. In fact, you know, I spent 2.5 years researching the, you know, Bilderberg roots at the National Library in Florence, and I can tell you that, you know, the real wealth is not measured in billions of dollars. It's actually measured in quadrillions of dollars. When I say quadrillions, it's just not, you know, I'm not just throwing a big number with lots of zeros at you to impress you. You know, I have one document from this, you know, Krupp German industrialist family, K-R-U-P-P. These are the people who sponsored, you know, Hitler, and these are the people who have been into the arms trade since the 19th century. Well, you know, this one extract in one bank account has 112 trillion dollars. I said trillion with T for Toronto. Now, why are they trying to sell us? You know, a ball boy or man who serves coffee to powerful people such as Bill Gates, which is what he is. Okay, uh-huh. You know, just a toilet cleaner in the real world. Why is he considered, you know, or Warren Buffett, another toilet cleaner? You know, why are these people considered to be the most powerful man in the world? When again, Krupp, who is not the most powerful, you know, he's kind of middle range, has, you know, $112 trillion in one bank account, and I have located over 3,000 bank accounts belonging to this man. Now, why are they doing this to us?
Well, I would have figured they're trying to do the same thing to us that they did to Russia, but why would you say?
Well, again, the idea is that it's a disinformation campaign. It's, you know,
okay.
The idea is that you put the facade up, same with Bilderberg. You know, Bilderberg is not, you know, the end-all, be-all, you know, boogeyman secret society. You know, I think the reason people believe in Bilderberg as being so powerful because, you know, I just happen to write a book about them. You know, if I write a book about I don't know, something else. Maybe they'll think that, you know, whatever that subject is the most powerful society in the world. But, you know, I think, you know, people have to understand that secret societies do control the world. And they have been controlling the world since, you know, the Egyptians, you know, 3,000-4,000 years ago. And I think the reason people don't believe in secret societies controlling the world is that theirs is a Cartesian fantasy world in which the isolated intentions of a very small group of individuals instead of the dynamics of social processes shape the course of history as the movement of, I'd say, evolving ideas and themes over successive generations. Again, you know, what we're talking about, you know, the secret societies. You know, Bilderbergers, as an organization, they were founded through the French Synarchist movement, which is, of course, the Martinist esoteric secret society. Now, the Synarchists were, the financiers of Hitler between 22 and 45. And the Synarchist movement was founded as the oligarchy's counterattack on the principles upon which the United States of America was founded. So, again, you know, talking about, you know, earlier on, you're talking about conspiracy theorists. I'm not a secret society historian or an arcane historian. My thing is literally going back 600-700 years and finding something that someone had, you know, tried their hardest, damnedest, to make sure nobody ever found. And I guess that's what I like about, you know, my work is matching wits with some nasty people from the bygone years.
So would you say that it's a group or individuals that are wielding the most power? And have you come to find out who they are?
Well, I know who some of them are, and that's saying a lot because, again, I spent 2.5 years researching these people and going back, you know, painstakingly going back in time. And I can tell you that one of the most powerful families in the world are the Venetian black noble family called the Frescobaldis. Now, if, you know, you're listening to this interview right now, you try to Google it, don't bother. You know, you're not going to find it. It's like you can find David Rockefeller because he's nothing. He's dung. But you'll never find, you know, Frescobaldis because they're very, very powerful. And again, you know, I discovered that, you know, what's today called the Bilderberg Group, you know, 800 years ago was called the Venetian black nobility. And they're still Venetian nobles, and they still control the world. For example, the Queen of England, Elizabeth II, you know, she's 50% Venetian noble through the Albert Azol family and 50% German from the Duchy of Wurttemberg. So, it's, you know, history is an amazing thing, especially if you understand it.
Well, so where do the Rothschilds come in this?
Well, they don't. You know, they're right there. You know, the dung number one and dung number two. You know, on the scale of dungs in the world history. Well, you know, the Rothschilds. Why shouldn't be so harsh? I mean, you know, the Rothschilds. You know, their wealth is at least older. You know, their money is 250 years old. The Rockefeller money is 150 years old, which is, you know, in human history terms, really is nothing. We're talking about Frescobaldis. We're talking about 1,000 years worth of, you know, wealth. You know, so there's a big difference. And again, their wealth is not measured in billions or in trillions. It's measured in quadrillions of dollars. And of course, most people simply can't get their brains around that kind of numbers because they just, you know, they don't think these numbers exist. When, you know, allegedly the United States government, you know, is having a hard time putting a trillion dollar, $700 billion, you know, rescue package for the American banks. You know, and they don't understand that actually it's just all smoke and mirrors. But there are, you know, quadrillions of dollars just lying there, you know, in dormant accounts waiting to be used, you know, to save the American economy.
So these guys the money's remained in the same hands probably for as long as history's recorded then to a point. Because, I mean, you're bringing it back to Italy as opposed to, you know, you keep hearing quite a bit about a Jewish control or Vatican or
it's Jewish control to illiterate individuals who do their researches from, you know, the safety of their living rooms by Googling words, you know, on in internet search engines. And if any of these people actually, you know, got their butts, off the couch, got on a plane and went somewhere where actually, you know, you actually see original documents, they'll realize, you know, the Jews have absolutely nothing to do with this. And I'm not defending the Jews, you know, as a matter of fact.
Right.
I, for example, I cannot get into Israel, not that I want to. I've been banned from entering Israel, you know, it was about, I think, 10 years ago. because of all the nasty stuff I spilled all over these, you know, the disgusting people, you know, and not the people, but the nation itself, what they've done to, you know, to the world. And actually the greatest menace to humanity right now is Israel. More than Iran, more than Iraq, more than North Korea, it's Israel that can actually cause, you know, the Third World War, because if they attack Iran, you just don't know what will happen. But, you know, what's interesting about, again, all these societies, you know, is the system itself, you know. It's a very dynamic system in that it changes with the times. It absorbs and creates new parts, you know, while excreting the remains of the decaying parts. Now, members come and go, say, of Arthur Anderson, for example, or Enron. You know, they die off, somebody new comes in. But the system itself, that's what's important to understand. The system itself has not changed. It is a self-perpetuating system. It's a virtual spider web of interlocked financial, political, economic, and industry interests with the Venetian ultramontane Fondi model at the center. You know, it's not about Jews controlling the world. It's about Venice, Venetian black nobility. They've been at it for 800 years. They're the ones that caused, you know, the financial meltdown in 1345 that wiped out, you know, all the major banking houses, including the Bardis and the Peruzzis, and brought on the Black Plague epidemic, which wiped out half of the European population. They're behind that. You know, they're behind, you know, the Napoleonic campaign as well. They're behind the creation of the Austrian army, which was actually used, you know, as what Madison Avenue would, you know, would do when they wanted to pump someone up. They'll give them fame and recognition when they had none, you know. So they created this, you know, Austrian army so that Napoleon could actually destroy them and become, you know, the emperor of Europe. Because, again, it all goes back to control. And, you know, over the past 650 years, and, you know, we've gotten a little bit away from the Shadow Masters into the Bilderberg, but, you know, the concept is, you know, what these people are after is not only creating One World Company Limited, but in order to do that, they must destroy every nation state on earth. Because with nation states, we have constitutions, we have, you know, natural law, we have general welfare. And general welfare isn't some, you know, big fat slop sitting on a couch eating pizza, watching television, collecting government unemployment checks. You know, it's actually, it's if you take it to a higher plateau, you know, and understand it, you know, from the intellectual point of view, you know, the question is, what, you know, what is the meaning of immortality? Why are we as people here on the planet? What are the roles of governments to the people? What is the role, our role, you know, to the future generations? You know, it has to do with one thing, you know, making sure that we as the people, the human race, survive. And for us to survive, the concept of general welfare is very, very important. It's our job to make sure that we provide for future generations. When we are dead, the world we leave for them is better than the world, you know, we've been left with when we were born. And unfortunately, the way things stand right now, future generations have no reason whatsoever to respect us, you know, as people, as generations. And again, that's one of the things that, you know, the Shadow Masters are trying to accomplish, destroy the human race, you know, wipe out humanity, you know, reduce the population base from almost 7 billion people to 2. Because, again, they don't need so many people. It has to do with, you know, preserving natural resources for themselves, obviously at our expense. And again, it goes back to the Venetian ultramontane Fondi model. And again, they won't succeed until Russia is destroyed. And needless to say, you know, they need to prop the markets up right now, dead markets, and they're using drug trade for that. And all of these things, you know, I go into, you know, a great detail in the Shadow Masters, which I think is a far better book than Bilderberg, although Bilderberg has sold 3.5 million copies worldwide. Shadow Masters is a far superior book because, you know, I couldn't have written it 5 years ago because I simply wasn't mature enough to, you know, to join the dots, you know, amongst all these very different subject matters, which I think I, you know, very masterfully put together and coherently in my new book.
Right. How did you get to interview Victor Boot?
Well, showed up at the Russian embassy. That's a really good question. I showed up at the Russian embassy, and you know, Victor Boot at the time was just burned by yet another Western news media, BBC, who did a hack job on the man, and he came out, you know, looking and sounding like a criminal. He wasn't. And, you know, the fact that I was Russian, the fact that, you know, I also spent some time in Africa in the 1990s, the fact that, I looked presentable and actually didn't have an ulterior motive, And I told him, I said, look, you know, I may be your only, chance in the West because I have a lot of credibility. A lot of people know who I am. And actually, Victor Booth knew who I was because he had read my book. The man is he speaks 10 languages fluently.
Wow.
In prison, he learned, Hindu, he learned Sanskrit, he learned Turkish, and he learned Iranian, okay, in prison. Okay, in the 2 years that he's been there, and he speaks it absolutely fluently. I talked to an Iranian general who is a friend of his who visits him very often, and I said to him, Michael, how's his, and he said it's perfect. He's absolutely, he's fluent. So this man speaks 10 languages, and he had read my book in English, and so I said, the only chances for this thing to work is for me to actually interview Victor and, try to get the whole story out. Now, I said to Victor Wood, I said, after our first meeting, I said, Victor, I'm writing a book and I need another 150 pages and I'm going to do it on you because, I realize that you're a key element of this entire, world control because you're just a pawn. If Victor Wood didn't exist, if Lee Harvey Oswald didn't exist, they would have invented another one, another Lee Harvey Oswald, another Victor Booth, another whoever, to take his place. It just happened to have been the Victor Booth, that's all. And he said, absolutely, I agree. But I said to him, Victor, I'm going to warn you right now that if you try to use me, if you ride me or lie to me, I'm going to find out. And you'd wish that actually Douglas Fair was doing a book on you because, I'm going to come down so hard on you. And he kind of smiled and he said, I've read your book. I know exactly who you are. I have no reason to lie to you. He said, I'm already in prison. And I said, that's fair enough. And, so we had, with the cooperation of the Russian embassy, because actually Victor Booth, he is in Klong Prem. They call it the Bangkok Hilton, the worst, the deadliest prison in all of Southeast Asia. He's shackled, his feet, his leg irons. 24 hours a day, he sleeps, being shackled to the floor in a room. It's like you don't get private, chambers in Klong Prem. You have 80 to 100 people to a room, and everybody has to sleep sideways because if they all lie on their back, there's just not enough room on the floor. That's what the conditions are in Bangkok. And he's been actually there for 2 years. And in these 2 years, he managed to learn to speak three languages, which is, amazing. So, a Russian embassy, I would go in as a translator, an interpreter, a constitutional expert, a lawyer, because you only have a 20-minute visit a day with Victor Booth, unless, of course, you're with the embassy or you come as a lawyer or come as a translator. And with the cooperation of the Russian embassy, I was actually able to see him almost every single day and record over, I think, 20,000 hours of conversation.
That's a lot of time.
Well, again, I don't sit around my living room on my butt, Googling words, drinking beer, watching television, eating an apple, and listening to rock and roll, while I do serious work. I actually get on the plane, go places, spend time there, spend money there. I get a lot of people, I'm not surprised that David Rockefeller Company aren't really afraid of us because, our side is just so full of losers. But losers, in every sense of the word. I get people saying to me, how is it that, you made so much money on Bilderberg? Because, I did sell 3.9 million copies, and it is a lot of money, So, the fact that you made so much money, makes me believe that you're one of them. What these people don't understand is that actually for me to go to Africa, for me to go to Thailand for 6 months, for me to go and spend 2.5 years living in Florence investigating, it's Florence is one of the most expensive cities in the world. An ice cream is about $12.
Woo.
Well, I'm not just going to have an ice cream. Well, that's fine. A bottle of water is about $6. Well, don't drink. Okay, a sandwich is about, $9. Well, don't eat. All right, well, let's see if I can do that for 2.5 years.
Right.
I had a 30-meter apartment, which cost me almost $2,500 a month. $2,500 for a 30-meter apartment.
Right.
And we're talking about New York being expensive. The fact is that, a lot of the money I actually make, is put to, good use being investigating. And 6 months in Thailand, that's a lot of money. And, investigating, running down leads and searching all this information out. Because, again, in 6 months, I've destroyed 15 years of American government duplicity. and needless to say, $80 million of taxpayers' money, which they, you know, used to very bad use, meaning that they framed a man, destroyed his family, you know, wiped out whatever little money. He has a 15-year-old daughter. Well, you know, she hasn't seen her father in 2 years. And the way things look right now, he'll probably be extradited to the United States, and she'll never see him again. All because, you know, some very powerful man, instead of balancing the books, need to control the world.
Well, I was wondering why they went after him. I mean, but you're saying they just needed somebody, so they picked him?
Well, it's not that simple. You know, any intelligence operation never has one objective. It has, you know, three, four, five objectives. You know, he was there in Africa. He was convenient. You know, he was working in the Russian embassy. You know, he was a junior lieutenant, which, you know, means that you could easily, you know, come, you know, made into a KGB officer, you know, by the Americans if they wanted to. You know, he was in the wrong place at the right time. You know, he was a bother to the Americans because, again, when they wanted to come back, they realized that Boo was controlling all of Africa. You know, Africa is full of natural resources. We have coltan, you have gold and diamonds and natural gas, and you have so much land that Africa could become a breadbasket for the entire world. You know, and needless to say, if you're the CIA, if you're the MI6, if you're Mossad, you know, if you control these nations, you can't do it if you can't actually get anywhere near them because this Ruski controls the entire continent. So they have to get them out, you know, because all of these NGOs, for them actually to get on the ground and to, you know, to put their operations in motion, and of course most of the NGOs, you know, are full of, you know, secret service agents, CIA, you know, MI6, you know, the Mossad, KGB, you know, all of these people are there, and all of them, you know, have their own objectives and own plans, destabilize regions, you know, sabotage operations, and needless to say, it doesn't help if, you know, this one guy controls the entire continent. So the plan was, you know, number one, get him out. Number two, you know, turn him into a boogeyman. Number three, go after him. And then number four, if you can actually hurt Russia in the process by somehow linking Viktor Boot to the Russian government and Russian state, you know, and some, other dark motives, well, you know, so much the better. And this is exactly what they've done. And this is exactly what I prove in my book. And the fact is that, you know, if he's ever brought it to the United States, he's going to be charged with, you know, trafficking in nuclear components. You know, that's about 300 years, you know, in the slammer. And again, I show in the book that the entire thing is a lie. And the American government is profoundly upset, very, very, very upset, that I actually came to Thailand and investigated this thing. And I've actually been told by my friends in the State Department not to show up in the United States because I'll be arrested. And the idea is, from what I've been told, for the government, you know, the story is that Viktor Boot's money is actually in my bank account, which is why he doesn't seem to have any money. And needless to say, you know, Viktor Boot and I, we're not friends. I don't, you know, have, you know, gun-dealing friends, you know, people who like Viktor Boot. But the point is that, you know, it just shows how far your government will go to actually discredit someone or use them for, you know, their very far-sighted policy agenda and objectives.
Wow. Well, I have to commend you on all your effort that you've gone to put this together. And you do have quite a bit of footnotes and documents in your book to, you know, show your
well,
case.
The funny thing is that, you know, the government, you know, you obviously understand that if I leave, you know, the door open even a millimeter or an inch, and I can give American government a chance to sue me for any inaccuracies in my book, obviously they would have done it.
Uh-huh.
But the fact is that not in the Bilderberg and not in the Shadow Masters, we haven't had one complaint or one lawsuit. And again, I'm going up against some of the most powerful people in the world, at least openly powerful. You know, people have, you know, billions of dollars of fortune, and none of them have dared actually, you know, to stand up and say, I'm going to take this man to court, because they know exactly what I have, because they know what I'm talking about.
Wow. You know, do you have any closing comments before we bring this to?
Yeah. Well, sometimes I wonder, you know, if you know, being a bus driver would have just made things much simpler.
Well, you know, it would have been, but it certainly wouldn't have been as interesting, I'm sure. But
you know, it's a very interesting subject matter. You know, not only the, you know, the from a philosophical point of view, you know, it's. It has to do with, for me, it has to do with development of mankind, you know, the development of the power of the individual and of the nation, which, you know, depends upon scientific development, which is used to increase the power of man over nature. And, you know, my thing is I try to explain to people that, you know, the whole thing about control and, you know, you've heard the term, the money elite, right?
Right.
There's a misconception in this. Yes, it's true that these people want an empire, and again, and too many people believe that in order to have an empire, you need money. But money is not a determinant of wealth. Money has no intrinsic value. You know, it doesn't affect the development of the planet. Human mind affects this development, and this is how mankind is measured. And what separates us from animals is our ability to discover universal physical principles. It allows us to innovate, which subsequently improves the lives of people. And this is what it's about, because, again, the circles around Gottfried Leibniz, the man who discovered calculus, you know, discovered this very, you know, long, long time ago, that development and progress is directly proportional to population density. So if we can develop the mind and discover universal principles of nature, we can actually destroy these people, because we can create people who actually will not be afraid to stand up to oligarchs. And that's one of the reasons why the globalists or the people who want to have an empire, which is basically the same thing.
Right.
I'm so afraid of people with higher principles, because, you know, people with higher principles are not afraid to die for the Constitution or for the future of humanity, which is, again, you know, for me, that's what immortality is all about. And, you know, I think that's a pretty good way to end this.
Well, and I want to again thank you for coming on my program, and it's been quite an interesting interview, and I hope down the road we can do this again.
I hope we can do this again many more times.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you.
Good night.